Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, it means spiritual struggle or effort, and some innovative religious in Syria are reviving it to bring Muslims, Christians, and Druze together to pray for peace and reconciliation amid the tensions there. Egypt is grappling with a rise in drug and alcohol abuse since the advent of the Arab Spring. We talk to an expert about the issues of concern in his country. And October 4th marks the feast day of the patron saint of animals and the environment. Can you guess who he is? Ever heard of a spiritual jihad? Well, that's what one group of Christians, Muslims, and Druze are doing in response to the unrest in Syria, where security forces have launched violent crackdowns on anti-government protesters. The monks and nuns to embark on a prayerful jihad are from the Deir Mar Musa al-Habashi, a 6th-century monastery of St. Moses the Assyrian, a Syriac Catholic monastic community located in the mountains of Nebek in northern Syria. Joined by Christians from other churches, Muslims and Druze from across Syria, the community has dedicated a week of prayer for reconciliation and peace in the country. The brainchild of Italian Father Paolo Dall'Oglio, who lives at the Syrian monastery, the spiritual jihad actually means spiritual effort. Christopher Wells asked him to give us an idea of the situation in Syria from his vantage point.
The fact is that the situation is not calm. The movement is still, let's say, going on. And violence is growing. Violence is clearly growing. What was possible to be done by a negotiation with the help of international negotiators and help, as we have been wished in all the past months, today is more difficult. We stay with this position. We wish to have international help for internal negotiation, but this now is more difficult. Should be done, but it's more difficult. So in this moment, as you know, there is a polarization. There is groups that have been outside the country organizing a kind of government to come next government after revolution, but things are not that far. In the country, there is many people with the government and the presidency, and that's why we are very much afraid of civil war, because there is not an overwhelming will of change. There is a very strong will of change in one part of the population, and there is a very strong will on not to change in a as big as the first part, another part of the population.
And Father, can you tell me what your monks and nuns are doing in confrontation with this situation?
We have done a week of prayer and fasting, and we call it spiritual jihad, spiritual effort, with this Arabic word that means two things, the holy war, but it means first and last the spiritual effort. So a spiritual jihad to face the growing of mutual violence with a mutual deep desire of reconciliation. We believe in the reconciliation. We have been seeing in those days youth coming to the monastery from all parts of Syria, all religious belongings, all political stands, and able to pray together and to ask the help of God for real reconciliation. So from the cultural point of view, it's absolutely clear that this is possible and needed.
And how is the Christian community, how does the Christian community fit in with the movements in Syria?
The Syrians are shocked by previous tragedies. You know, we have had 18 years of Lebanese war, and then from 2003, the Iraqi tragedy, and the Christians feel that they go always victims of conflicts of others. So the Oriental Christians are for the status quo because they cannot imagine a change without losing their positions. But I don't know if this is a good idea. Even the presidency of Syria has expressed several times a deep need for change. So they know that the change should come and should be the good one. For there is a natural, let's say, evolution toward real democracy. And this is a general movement in the world, thank God, and now also in the Arabic world. So this is coming also here. I think the Christians should cope with this new reality, offering their participations. There should be a kind of meniscus in the knee of the country, and offering the capacity of a mediation between the different parts. And we work with the idea of a democracy of consensus, so where there is not a democracy of the dictatorship of a majority on the minorities. We have to work for an alternative to that.
And finally, Father, what are your hopes for the immediate future? What are you looking forward to?
I think also through the Vatican Radio, I want to call not only hope, but a real call for other efforts of negotiation. The sanctions that have been decided and the one that are proposed are against the civil society, against the people. So we are already suffering of this. We don't need another Iraq here. It's a very bad choice to make sanctions on the people. What should be asked for is a schedule of real negotiation, step by step, asking for the protection of the persons, the warranties for the prisoners, the intervention of the Red Cross, other peaceful organizations, to make it possible to go toward the changes in a peaceful, reasonably peaceful way. And all the countries should work for that. I'm thinking about, obviously, in English, the English-speaking world, but we have been thinking about the role of Brazil. Turkey, obviously, is very important. Europe is essential. Iran should not take out of the game. Syria is important for everybody, so everybody should do something for Syria.
Father Dall'Oglio's call for peace and reconciliation comes as Syria's main opposition groups join together to call on the international community to take action to protect the Syrian people. In a statement issued earlier this week, they rejected foreign intervention that compromises Syria's sovereignty, but said the outside world has a humanitarian obligation to protect the Syrian people. Egyptian authorities have been struggling to contain drug and alcohol abuse among one of the biggest populations of young people in the Middle East and North Africa. Opium and hashish abuse has been a problem in Egypt for centuries, and recent tests have even revealed traces of cocaine in the remains of mummies. Well, Egypt has become one of Africa's leading black market cultivators of cannabis and opium poppies, and the levels of narcotic consumption have jumped alarmingly in the past 3 decades, particularly among the young and disadvantaged. Addicts in Egypt are spending upwards of $3 billion on drugs each year, and rehab centers are struggling to meet the needs of more and more young people seeking a way out of addiction. And according to Dr. Mohamed El-Handawi, a psychiatrist with Egypt's Office for Addiction Services at the Ministry of Health, authorities have seen substance abuse jump further since protesters took to the streets of Cairo earlier this year, demanding freedom and democracy after 30 years under the rule of President Hosni Mubarak. Well, Susie Hodges caught up with Dr. El-Handawi during a recent visit here to Rome, where he was conferring with Italian colleagues about addiction treatment and prevention strategies.
As an expert in the area, I see that. I see the rate of addiction, or at least abuse, is going higher, and even the type of substances is changing. The ages of the users are going down, and the doses of the use are going up. Why is that happening? I suppose it's fear. It's anxiety. It's exhaustion. These are the three main reasons I can see it. I'm not saying that we are having gunshots in Cairo or something chaotic, but we are Egyptians, are somehow superstitious. They like to feel calm about the future. They like to feel some security. The unknown future is causing lots of fear.
So there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yes.
I mean, do you feel then that people are tiring at the slow pace of reform, are getting a bit disillusioned?
Yes, I believe that, especially the younger generation, the 20-something generation.
In the first democratic referendum in your country in March 2011, an overwhelming majority of voters approved a package of constitutional amendments, including parliamentary elections and the election of members of parliament to form a constitutional assembly.
Mm-hmm.
But and the Muslim Brotherhood encouraged voters to turn out for the referendum, voting yes. But secularists and liberals voted against the package. Are they afraid of democracy?
No, not at all. I voted against what the Islamic Brotherhood was asking for. But the election, people were coming from the voting locations or centers saying, no matter what the result is, the new gain is 18 million people went to vote. This is a first in the Egyptian history. I know that in the first steps of doing democracy, it's very liable to do mistakes. It's okay. But let's start.
And how much support does the military have in the country right now?
To be honest, they are doing all what they can. We cannot complain about what they are doing, but we know that the job is very big. The job is very new to them. They are not used to do such things. They are supporting as much as they can do without harming anyone. And to be honest, this is starting to be a hard job.
And how much support does the Muslim Brotherhood enjoy? And are they as moderate as many profess?
Well, it's a little... this is something controversial, you know. Talking about services to community or community work or something, they are doing lots of things, to be honest with you. Lots of concern about their involvement in the coming elections are... genuine concerns, yes. But as a new party, as a new era in Egypt, nothing is certain. We have just to wait and see what will happen.
Now, there's a number of right-wing Islamist parties that have sprung up. How large are their followings and what do you attribute their success to?
I think, and this is my personal opinion, I think they are... very organized, knowing each other. It's like they are being prepared for something like that, compared to other political parties. But I don't see that the whole street is belonging to them. Actually, many protesters in Tahrir Square have made it clear that we want a civil state, nothing religious at all.
And... If, say, elections were to be held tomorrow, who's likely to win? Or who would win?
I don't know. This is a problem. No one knows. Lots of people would bet on the Islamic Brotherhood, but I don't know.
It's indeed difficult to gaze in the crystal glass. Now, President Mubarak and his top advisers have been put on trial. Is that enough to expiate the crimes of the past regime? What do Egyptians want now?
Well, let me tell you something. It's like there was something, someone is annoying you for 30 years, and right now you want to see him suffer. That's all. I don't believe that the trials working now are really expressing what this regime used to do. They are they are in court for days, not for the last 30 years. What do Egyptians want? They want some sort of justice. They want to feel that we lived bad years, so it's time to pay back. That's all.
When we look at Egypt's population, of course, a huge number are young people, half of whom are reported to be out of work. I mean, who's listening to their voice in the political arena?
Right now, it's the new parties. They are forming new parties. And let's say the older parties like the Islamic Brotherhood, Wafd Party, are listening. The current government are doing their best. I don't see it personally as the best they can do, but they are trying to do their best. The military council are doing their best. But if you're asking about if there is a legitimate channel they can talk through, I don't see that there is one. It's only the Tahrir Square right now.
And presumably this large number of young, unemployed people must be helping to fuel, as you say, drug use and
yes,
other forms.
Yes, of course. Yes, sure.
When the uprisings began in the spring in Egypt, we saw many photos of Muslims and Christians side by side demanding
yes.
freedom
mm-hmm.
and change. But mm-hmm. since then, we've heard of increasing attacks on churches and Christians around the country. What has happened to change things there?
Well, most of people, and I do believe the same too, this is not the truth, at least for me. I'm living in Egypt, and I have many Christian friends than that I do have Muslims. I don't see that the problem is the same size as sometimes it appears to be. Somehow, some people believe, and I'm one of them, that there's something wrong. There's something like to be, let's say, conspiracy.
But so you're saying that, generally speaking, even now, there's fairly good relations in general between Christians and Muslims?
Yes, in the ordinary street, yes. This is what happens.
Mm-hmm. But relations with Israel have soured in the post-Mubarak area.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of relationship do most Egyptians want with Israel? How do they view Israel?
Well, it's not a secret. It's almost anger for what they have been doing to the Palestinians. About the Egyptians, there was an incident, a near incident of shooting through the borders that caused lots of anger. And the period where people are finally free to say what they want. It was more than it should have been, but it was expected to see that rejection and anger in the streets. What do people want? They want to feel even. They want to feel justice. There has been a feeling, and I'm talking about myself. This is how I feel personally. There had been a feeling that we are a second degree after the Israelis. Even when we talk to them, they are higher than us. So what the Egyptians want, they want to be level to level. This is how I see it.
And when it comes to the future, how do people feel in general in Egypt about the future? Is there a sort of cautious optimism, or are they still rather worried, as you say, about this climate of uncertainty that prevails at the moment?
Most of people are optimistic, yes, seeing a better future is coming. But when it will start to come, this is the question.
Coming back to the young people, as you said, talking about the drug abuse and things like that, is there a fear there that many of the young people will perhaps pick up some of the, let's say, more questionable habits of, say, Western youths when it comes to, you know, drug abuse or alcohol abuse? Is there a worry there they'll pick up the bad habits of the West?
Not that much, because the base we're talking about in the drug abuse sector and the drug abuse population is not actually the higher social levels that are somehow following the Western culture.
What social groups is drug abuse most concentrated in?
Right now, it's spread among all groups. But what I see from working in the governmental sector mostly is from the low socioeconomic level. So actually, most of them, they don't know a lot about Western habits.
During his visit to Rome, Dr. El-Handawi says he was struck by the beauty of this eternal city. His fellow Egyptians, he reflected, would do well to regain their sense of beauty and their pride in their national heritage.
I wish we Egyptians regain our sense of beauty once again. We lost it many years ago. I believe that Cairo is a very beautiful city. Just it needs some order and some thinking about it again. Once you started to look to beauty and enjoy beauty, you will not do something that will demolish it. And that's a start. In Egypt, after January, a new spirit was born. People were cleaning the streets for the first time in decades. People were painting the walls. People were removing litter. People were doing the charity in rates that no one could ever imagine. So the remaining thing, I believe, is seeing beauty as a beauty.
And now, he's a 13th century Italian hilltown saint associated with nativity scenes, animals, and creation. Catholic religious and secular orders have been named for him and dedicated to his rule of poverty. If you haven't guessed who he is by now, I'll tell you. Of course, he's St. Francis of Assisi, who has inspired countless men and women throughout the centuries to dedicate their lives to helping others and doing God's work. The church celebrates his feast day every October 4th, and this year there's also a special anniversary involved, which will see Pope Benedict himself taking part. Well, Franciscan Father Joseph Rozanski, the director of the Office for Justice, Peace, and the Integrity of the Creation for the Order of Friars Minor, tells Chris Wells more about the saint who inspired his vocation and what's being planned to celebrate him in coming weeks.
Many people are somehow or another inspired by this man who lived 800 years ago, and I think that it's because of the depth of his love, you know, for his fellow human beings and for all of creation, and his willingness to struggle for them and to struggle for a world that would look more like God's kingdom. You know, when you look and see the conversion of Francis, the process that he went through, he comes to the conclusion that he needs to live the gospel life, and he takes on that task with as much enthusiasm as he can muster. You know, and so when you look around, you know, his conversion, why did it happen? At least one of the reasons was because of the lepers that he saw in his own society. And, the sight of the lepers, he said, it really nauseated him at the beginning, but then it became a sweetness for him. You know, once he saw it within this task of his to work for God's kingdom in this world. You know, and then I think most people, again, you ask why would people be influenced by him? I think most people, when they think about Francis and they think about Franciscans today, you know, they expect us to be concerned with peace, because that was one of the main themes that Francis promoted. You know, he used the greeting, "May the Lord give you peace." But it was more than a greeting for him. You know, if you look through the writings, Francis was always working concretely to bring peace to people. You know, whether it was in the city of Assisi, other Italian cities, the famous story of the Wolf of Gubbio, where Francis goes to Gubbio and converts the wolf that was killing people. You know, and also the famous story of Francis and the Sultan. You know, when the other Christians were fighting with the Muslims, Francis was there trying to promote peace. So I think people expect, you know, they see in Francis and expect of us work for peace, also against poverty, and also for creation, for our world, you know, for all the creatures that God gave us. So I think for these reasons, people are drawn to Francis.
And a big part of the questions of peace today involve interreligious dialogue. We know the conference at Assisi is coming up. Could you speak about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, it was called Pope John Paul II ended up calling the meeting and the movement really that he founded the Spirit of Assisi, because he invited the heads of many different religions to come to Assisi and together to think about how we might be people of dialogue and of peace, of promoting these values in our world today. And he encouraged all of the religions to pray in their own way for peace, as he encouraged us too, as Catholics, to pray for peace and to work for it. So the 25th anniversary of the Spirit of Assisi is this year on the 27th of October. And as a Franciscan family, we really have encouraged our brothers and sisters to get involved locally with the celebration. And once again, Pope Benedict will be going. He will be going to Assisi to celebrate in the spirit of John Paul II and in the spirit of the gospel, of what the gospel calls us to. You know, so the celebration of the 25th anniversary reminds us of a task that is perennial, that has to happen all the time. But in a special way, John Paul II, he chose Assisi because of the way that people identify Francis with this theme of peace and with the dialogue for peace. So I think that's why for us it's important. It's built right into our charism as Franciscans, and I would say into our charism as Christians. You know, when you look and see the gospel and the work of Jesus, you know, to bring peace among people, I think that we're all challenged to take up this work in our world today. And God knows all we need to do is turn read a newspaper or turn on the news to know that our world has not yet become God's kingdom. You know, so we need to be about this task of promoting peace, as Jesus did, and as Francis, following in the footsteps of Jesus, also did in his life.
And you spoke too about St. Francis' commitment to the world and to creation, his appreciation of God's works. That's become an increasing part of Pope Benedict's message to the world. He speaks about ecological issues. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Certainly, Pope Benedict has continued once again this tradition that started with John Paul II. John Paul II called us all to ecological conversion. And what he meant basically was that, God has created all of us as part of the world, as part of this bigger creation. And, you know, scientifically, it seems that more and more our own human activity is interfering in the world. It's bringing about changes. And so there are very, very large movements to question the way that we run our world economically, the way that we, the ideas that we have about development and about constant growth. All of these call into question, you know, our lifestyle, the way that we live. And so I think that Pope Benedict is reminding us about that. You know, as Christians, we've always been concerned about our lifestyle. And how that influences our spiritual life, you know, how we can grow in God, or how maybe we can forget to grow in God because we become so enamored of the world and the things of our world. Francis loved creation. Francis loved the animals. Francis loved people. Francis loved everything that God created, and he promoted as much as he could the values that would help to maintain creation, to keep it the beautiful place that God gave us. You know, so I think in the spirit of Francis, we're all challenged to look and see what's going on in our world today and to ask ourselves what we can do. I think personally, there are things that we can do to change our own lifestyle. Communally, you know, as a Christian community or even as civil communities, we need to ask ourselves, you know, what are we doing to promote our world and to promote our brothers and sisters? You know, and so in this sense, you know, I think that we need to be concerned about the political realities of our world. You know, as Christians, we're not called to live with our head in another world. But I think with the eyes of Jesus, we're called to look at our world, to read the signs of the times, you know, about what's good and what's not good about the way that we do things. And then to really to put ourselves to the task, you know, of trying to bring about the changes that will make, you know, life better for everybody.
Franciscan Father Joseph Rozanski. And I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.